The BS Report is presented by Subway. Football season is over. Footlong season is just beginning. For a limited time, get any piled high regular footlong for just $5. Any footlong, just $5. Hurry in, Subway. Eat fresh. Eat fresh. The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. Our friend, Rick Bucher, what's happening?
Oh, I was wondering what that music was. Was that Subway bumper music?
Yeah, it was. Subway is a sponsor now, so we're getting a little promotion there.
Wow, that's really big. By the way, thanks. I'm really honored that you couldn't see anybody else, and you called me at the last second to pinch hit.
It wasn't the last second. It was like 3 hours before.
Okay. All right. I think we're probably mincing words here, but no, it used to be. I can remember a time where getting on the BS Report had to be scheduled like months in advance. There was such a waiting list. It was out the door and around the block. And now you got sponsorship, and it's pretty much, holy cow, we don't have anybody today. Let's see if we can get Bucher.
We had somebody today. They canceled.
Out on you?
Well, no, it was a schedule conflict. But
Who was it?
I'm not saying, because we want to have him on next week. I don't want to say.
You're going to have him on next week?
Why?
Whoever bailed on you, found something more important to do?
It wasn't a bailing.
Next week?
It was a schedule conflict. I initially wanted to have a three-man podcast with you, me, and Stein, but I think this is more fun, and the more I thought about it, I think Steiny Mo is still under suspension for not giving us a scoop at the end of our 70-minute three-man podcast.
Oh, that was ridiculous.
It was just
so ridiculous. He's become so careful these days. But then again, he's been doing some yeoman's work breaking stories. So it's a little weird now. I don't know if you know about this the way this works now is where we're like we have something and we have all the emails and we shoot an email to .com and to the news desk and. It's like if you beat the other guy by 10 seconds, then you get credit for the scoop, even though we're basically all calling the same people, getting essentially the same stuff. It's pretty funny. So then you watch the crawl to see, okay, was I the first one in or not? It's really funny.
I was just going to ask you about that.
Yeah.
So it's this recent phenomenon in the last 2 years. Whoever reports something first, it's put on the ticker.
Yeah.
And this has been the case now, I'd say, for like 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
But really, you're reporting something that's about to happen anyway. Like if you're saying, on the ticker today, if it says, Rick Bucher reports that Joe Smith will sign with the Cleveland Cavaliers.
Right, right.
Well, they're going to have a press conference tomorrow telling us that.
Right.
Like to me, it's like we should only tout who broke a story if it's something significant. Like Rick Bucher reports that Mark Cuban has been arrested for gambling on basketball or something like that. Like that's a scoop.
It's not a bad call, and it's why I don't really get that. I mean, if I have something, I'll shoot it to him, or if I think nobody else has it, I'll shoot it to him. But you're right. It's eventually going to get out there. We got 3 or 4 people who can get basically the same thing. So I try not to expend too much energy on. Am I going to be the first one by 15, 30 seconds, a minute, 5 minutes, whatever it may be?
Well, also,
I agree with you. I agree with you. It doesn't deserve like we're reporting something that's earth shattering. Like the Cavs, Joe Smith going to the Cavs and Drew Gooden going to the Spurs. And we've been talking about that for a couple of days now. So I don't know that it merits this big, big shocking announcement.
Like Steiny Mo had the thing about Marbury that Boston was considering Marbury. Now that was a story that hadn't been out there and was kind of a shocking story because of the history between Garnett and Marbury And then it led to a whole week of how, you know, how much validity is there to this. And then it turned out there was. And like, that's an example of, you know, whereas like this other stuff, it would make more sense to me if there was a scoreboard. Like if there was some blog that was keeping track, like Bucher is leading David Aldridge and Mark Stein 8-7 right now.
Right.
So maybe somebody should do that.
But, well, I guess you could, but you know what? There's enough people out there that are pushing to be first on things, where they're pushing the envelope on the accuracy of it, that I don't know that that would necessarily be a good thing. And you and I got into this a little bit off podcast, talking about how you couch what you know, or how you write what you know, so that you are being as accurate as possible.
Right.
With yet leaving room. I mean, here's the thing. You know, the Plain Dealer came out and said, you know, very early on that Joe Smith was going to the Cavs. I know that as of yesterday, there was a chance that that could have come apart. And he could have been headed to the Lakers, that things got a little contentious as they were putting the final strokes, on the deal. So, you know, at the end of the day, does the Plain Dealer look wrong? No, because, Smith ended up there, but were they completely on the beam when they first came out with it? Maybe not. And so my biggest issue right now is you have people who put things there, that are not couched, that put it out there early because they want to be first,
and they're hoping they're right,
and then they're not right. There's no culpability. Okay, you said this is going to happen and it didn't, and it just kind of goes by the boards.
Yeah, and there's a couple ways you can screw up. Like, for instance, with the terrible boat tragedy that just happened with the two football players. And I think one of the TV stations in Florida reported that one of the two football players had been found and he was alive. And then it turned out they were wrong.
Right.
Now that's as big of a screw up as you can have. Because not only did you pass along bad information, but you raised the hopes of this family that their son was alive when he wasn't. But then there's other types where, you know, you can kind of try to jump the gun on a story.
Yeah.
But it might not necessarily have happened yet, but you're convinced that it's probably going to happen. And I think this is a relatively recent thing with the internet, where you have people floating stuff out, hearing that it possibly could happen, but not knowing if it's going to happen, and then it just goes up. And I'm not saying the Cleveland Plain Dealer did that. I'm just saying this seems to be something that happens more often than not, especially near the trading deadline. People just throwing out trades. Hey, this is going to happen, and it doesn't.
No, absolutely. And the interesting thing for me is that I've seen where a deal gets out. There's a couple of things that happen. One, GMs and teams now routinely float things out there to get the public reaction before they execute it. And there are times where if the reaction is strong enough in a negative way, they pull back and they don't do it. And the other one is simply that it gets out there and it's at a sensitive stage, and one of the people involved sees it in print or sees it out there in the light of day, and they get cold feet and it ends up not happening. And I always feel a little, I've been in situations where I know about something that is at a delicate stage, and I will resist putting it out there because I don't want to be a factor in whether the deal happens or not. I would rather not get the scoop than become an element that decides whether it happens or not.
A pawn. Yeah, two elements intrigue me about that. First of all, that GMs, as you said, now use the media to kind of gauge the public reaction. Let me throw this out there. And we know who the GMs are who do this. Just kind of float it out. Will people be mad? How mad will they be? Whatever.
Yep.
The second part I don't understand. I don't understand how anything gets out. Like, for instance, you know, obviously it's in the other GM's interests Like if Phoenix decides, we have to trade Amari Stoudemire. We have to cut payroll. Here's our best bet. And they talk to a couple teams. Now, with those teams, it's in their interest to float it out. Hey, they're shopping Amari because they know his stock's going to drop.
Right.
So I always wonder how teams get to the stage where, you know, like what Phoenix did with Amari, where, all right, how do we shop this guy? How do we shop this guy without it getting out and without having his value killed? It's a
weird thing. I'll tell you, because as you might know, I'm working on a book that sort of gets an inside look at these various jobs around the league.
I'm very excited about this book.
What's that?
I'm excited about this book. I think it's going to be cool.
I am too. And I had a chance to spend some time with a GM at the trade deadline, and I heard. I literally got a chance to hear how these conversations go and how it's not directly said, but it's insinuated.
Yeah.
A certain move is insinuated and it's not really put out there. It's just something is said by way of the conversation that tips you off that, hey, you know what? That guy's going to be available, or hey, they don't believe he's going to be back. And then what happens is that GM and his staff mull over that conversation. And so now you have three or four people that are conscious of something that was said indirectly and where that goes. And here's the truth of it. They love the trade gossip like we do. So
right.
When they're on the horn with other people from other teams, that stuff comes up in conversation and information is exchanged that way. And all throughout the year, you've got a personnel director, you've got a college scouting director, you've got a GM, you've got an assistant GM, and all of those people have various people in other organizations that they talk to at various levels.
Yep.
And so there's this great sort of organic mixing of information that's flowing through these different avenues, and that's why you get what you get, and you get partial stuff. And then there's the whole other thing where you get like teams that are trading other teams' players, and I think sometimes it's done just to foment discord. Let's say that they threw this guy in a deal because the numbers work. In fact, that team actually has never discussed moving that guy.
Yeah.
But it works with the plans of another team, and so they go ahead and they throw it out there.
Well, all right, let's look at the Phoenix thing again. So they want to trade Amari, or they decide that let's see what we can get for him, but they don't want it to be out that they're shopping.
Right, right.
So they'll call Memphis, and they'll say, hey, we're really interested in Rudy Gay and Mike Conley. What would it take?
Right.
So Memphis says, oof, Rudy Gay and Mike Conley. Man, I mean, you'd probably have to give up Amari for that. And then Phoenix is like, really? Oh, well, let's talk about it. Well, we're going to have a meeting and we'll get back to you. But meanwhile, they've successfully flipped it. That's how I would handle it.
It wouldn't even be that direct. It would be that sometimes it's like, wow, you know, we really don't have a high scoring power forward on the block.
Yeah.
and they won't mention the guy by name. They'll just describe him. But that's the way it goes. Or they'll bring up one name and the other team will bring up, another, you know, they'll say, hey, we're looking at moving so and so. And the other team will say, or one team will say, we're interested in this guy. And that team will say, well, that guy or this other guy, to see how zeroed in the team is on a particular player.
I do this one in my fantasy leagues, especially in this intensive American League baseball only league that I'm in, where you call somebody, you talk to him about two of his players for 15 minutes. And then in the last minute, you bring up the player you really want. Oh, by the way, what about Brandon Moore is not available, right? Just kind of throw it out there, and the guy.
Right.
So I think that's what they must do.
No. That happens too. I mean, I heard conversations about one player that, you know, sort of finding out what the availability of a particular player was, and that was only the pretense of a different conversation.
Right.
or vice versa. And so it's interesting. But by the way, because you have made it well known that you should be a GM in the league, or you could be better than half the GMs in the league.
No, three-fourths.
Having seen, like, I don't know about you, but I got into this because I don't particularly like doing math, and I'm not particularly good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And being a GM now is almost like being a CFO.
Yeah.
And the housekeeping that you have to do as far as non-basketball things are concerned, is things that have nothing to do or very little to do with actually putting together a winning team, is phenomenal. You do as much hand-holding and psychology and Dr. Phil work and then crunching numbers. It's like all the things that you think would make being a GM a lot of fun, that's like maybe 10% of the job now.
Well, I got a 690 on math on my SAT, so I'm prepared on that end. I'm not worried. I don't know about the psychology part. I'm a little more worried.
Yeah, 690, that's pretty good.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Well, when I take over the Clippers next year, I have a whole master game plan of the stuff I want to come.
You don't really want that.
I do. I'll take a massive pay cut.
You have to hang out with and talk to on a daily basis?
Yeah.
If you're the Clippers GM?
Listen, I have a whole plan.
Why would you do that?
Do you want to hear my plan?
Sure.
I hire Sam Cassell as my coach.
Okay.
What do you think of that?
I think you just ratcheted the insane asylum factor up another 10 notches.
Well, but here's why I do it.
Okay.
The Clippers are going to stink anyway. I want somebody that the fans actually like and care about, and this is why I don't understand why teams don't take more chances with coaches and GMs. Like, if you're a team like the Clippers, the Bucks, the Pacers, you got to do something out of the ordinary to drum up some interest in your team, you know? So the Clipper fans, really, they've only had one fun season in the last 25, other than, I guess you could say, maybe the Larry Brown season, so maybe two. They all think that Sam Cassell was single-handedly responsible for what happened to them in 2006. None of them think Dunleavy is responsible. It's all Sam Cassell.
Okay.
They feel indebted to him. They like him.
Right.
He's the guy that brought them this one happy thing. Why wouldn't you make him the coach? And how could he be worse than Mike Dunleavy? He can't.
Okay. The fans love Sam. Everybody who plays for him hates him.
Everybody plays with him.
Have you made any progress?
What do you mean? You're saying Sam's other teammates hate him.
I'm saying that Sam as a coach, which he's sort of been for the last couple of years since he really can't play anymore.
Right.
Has even in the confined space that he's allowed to work in, has rubbed players the wrong way.
So you're saying, like, now, over maybe not the first season, but by year two, year three, he's driving them crazy.
By the end of the first season.
Yeah, but I went to those 2006 games. He ran that team, and they would have made
Western
finals.
But here's the difference: he could still play. He could still this is the thing for NBA players: is if you can make them better, or you can get it done, then they are going to listen to you. Now, if you're a coach and what you give them does not make them better, does not work, then you lost them. And the same goes as a player. That's why having a veteran presence in the locker room who can't actually do it on the floor anymore doesn't do anything for you. Because it's all about, hey, look, if you're going to tell me what to do, you got to be able to do it on the floor. If you can't, I'm going to try it my way. I'm not listening. And people may look at that and say that they're all prima donnas, but here's the reality. If you have an editor who can't make your stories better, and I think you've probably run into this in a certain in a couple of situations, if they can't improve what you're writing, are you going to how enthused are you going to be about the story ideas they bring you, or handing your story over to them? You're it's going to be a struggle.
But well, hold on, hold on.
We're going to say, hey, you know what? I got to do something.
Hold on, though. How many coaches honestly have an impact on a team in a positive way? Because it seems like for every one that has a positive impact, five don't.
Yep.
Would you agree with that, that ratio?
The problem is that it's not just the coach. It's the coach and his relationship with the GM. It's whether they have the same vision of where they're going.
Yeah.
And then is the owner involved? It's so difficult to isolate a guy and say, you know what, he's either doing a great job or he's not doing a great job, because there are so many elements going on that impact his ability to do his job. He could be a very good coach, but he's got so many things working against him that he doesn't have a chance. And that happens as much as anything. The really, it's funny. I was just looking at the guys. I just did a piece for the magazine about role players that could be X factors in the postseason.
Okay.
Roger Mason, Trevor Ariza, Courtney Lee.
Ooh, I like all three of those.
And Delonte West. Okay. Hmm. And I was looking at, like, I was looking at how they're structured and how they're coached and their organization. And I thought, you know what? All of the teams that we're talking about have very defined systems. And the hierarchy, as far as how things work between the GM and coach, are very well defined. And so you can go out and get a guy who's a bust elsewhere and bring him into your organization, and you suddenly look like a genius. And that happens time after time after time with the same organization.
Well, here's what I don't get. And I went to the Spurs-Clippers game on Monday night, sitting, you know, whatever, how many rows behind the Spurs bench, just watching that bench.
Yep.
And, you know, and I emailed you after the game, and I was just like, I will always go see the Spurs in person because that's just what I want to see for my basketball team. I want to see a coach who just has command of the situation and a sense of humor and is intense. And you have his relationship with Duncan is unparalleled. Duncan's relationship with his teammates is unparalleled. Yep. That team, when they show up, they look like a team that is like showed up in Vegas to go play blackjack for a few hours. Like, that's how loose they are.
Yep.
And if I'm another team, I'm just trying to figure out how I can copy them. So what do? Well, they only go for good guys. If they roll the dice with one head case, it's only going to be one, and they're not going to keep that guy. And I think we just saw that with Drew Gooden.
Yep.
Kind of a head case, but they don't have any other head cases on the team, so he's not going to get in trouble. But
and he's not really a head.
He's a goofball.
He's not a malicious head case.
No, he's a goofball. And let the record show, he grew a beard on the back of his neck. So I think that qualifies him for goofball status. But I think Presti went to the city that shall not be named and just basically tried to emulate what the Spurs did. He went after Jeff Green, fantastic guy. Went after Durant, fantastic guy. Went after Russell Westbrook, fantastic guy. Now he's got his coach in place, Scotty Brooks, who is top, maybe the most underrated coach right now of all, you know, somebody you never hear. And try to get rid of all his head cases. Really seemed like he wanted to keep Joe Smith just because he was a good guy. And is just going to basically emulate what San Antonio did. I don't understand why other teams don't do this.
I wish I could. Here's the thing. It depends on the timeline, and it depends on the level of desperation that a GM or coach has.
Right.
And you saw this. You see this with, I think you see this with the Celtics right now to a certain extent. To me, that's why you bring in a Stephon Marbury. It smacks of a hint of desperation that, you know what? We know that we're probably not good enough to get this done right now, and this may be our last shot at getting it done. So let's go ahead and roll the dice and see if we can pull something out of the bag. And I dare say that's what causes a lot of these decisions where you kind of look at it and you scratch your head, and it's the ego of the GM or the coach too to say either I or my organization can keep this guy on the rails. and we can get something out of them that somebody else can't.
Well, they handled it the right way. Like they had the best three guys in the team and the coach involved from the get-go. Should we do this? What do you guys think? And I think that's at least a decent way to handle it versus just bringing the guy in and saying, you guys deal with this.
I would say that kind of happens in every situation. I mean, I don't know that anybody makes a unilateral decision without checking it out with the best player on the team and having some discussion about it. It's not somebody who just gets a wild idea and makes it happen. My issue is that you're not going to talk to guys who are probably going to be affected the most. And to me, that's the guys whose minutes are impacted by Steph being there. And I'll go back to what happened with the Warriors when they brought Chris Webber in. You look at it and you go, hey, it's a nice story, Nelly and Webber getting back together and patching it up, and they add a piece. Well, that was the beginning of the end with Al Harrington and Don Nelson, in large part because Nelly said to Al, hey, you know what, we're not bringing Webber in here to sit on the bench.
Well,
he's coming in here and he'll be taking your minutes.
We saw it happen with the Celtics last year. They brought in Sam Cassell, and Eddie House went in a funk. Every time he came in, he was trying to score 5 points at once.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's true.
So that's where you can look at it and say, okay, everybody's on board. Everybody understands the risk. We got the guys who can keep them. But the fact is, you don't really have control over what impact that's going to have because it impacts everybody, and you don't know ultimately at the end of the day how everybody's going to react to it. So that's where there's a danger. And hey, you know what? Sometimes the risk and reward is worth the risk.
I gotta
decide.
I think the Celtics might have lost the title last summer if they end up losing it. And you know, I defend the Posey thing. It was too much money, and I think they were smart about not wanting to do 4 years. But they replaced him poorly. They spent his money on Tony Allen. They overpaid Freddie House. They paid for O'Brien. They brought Cassell back. They never addressed the situation of, we've lost Posey and we cannot go small anymore. And that's the biggest difference between last year's team and this year's team, is that they don't have that capability now to throw out a small lineup with KG at center. I think they're going to miss it in the playoffs, especially if the Cavs play LeBron and power forward.
Yeah.
They're in some serious trouble.
But here's the other part to that, and you and I have talked about this, is, and maybe they've righted the ship a little bit, but the Celtics have probably been the least respected defending champion that I can think of in some time.
You're right.
Simply because how they have handled themselves and how they've carried themselves, and instead of, you know, the intimidation factor is not there, a huge resentment is there. And I said it at the time, when a rookie in Charlotte, DJ Augustine, is calling you out and doing it with impunity, that's not a good sign. And I dare say that people around the league look at it and go, hey, you know what, you guys won a championship and you guys came together, but holy cow, could you carry yourself with a little more dignity, a little more like you are champions rather than sort of we told you so.
Yeah, there's two kinds of defending champs. I mean, obviously any defending champ's going to have a target on their back and people are going to get fired up to play them. The Celtics might have broken the record this year for most teams that actually have an axe to grind against them.
It's like every team they
play wants to murder them. Like you go from like the Knicks, the Bobcats, the Sixers, the Hawks, the Lakers, the Cavs. And the list is like 10 deep. And I think it's worn them down a little bit. And it was a big reason why they collapsed in December.
I agree. It not only has it worn them down, but you know, the other element here is that you did bring a number of guys together who had to expend an awful lot of energy last year. And I don't know that coming out this year the way they did was necessarily the best thing. It was almost, you'd almost wanted to find a reason to shut all those guys down for like the first month and maybe fall to fifth or sixth best in the Eastern Conference and then gather, then have them gather themselves for the run. Like have everybody doubting them, having every, it's a little bit of the San Antonio Spurs model again, where we don't care how we start. I mean, they've traditionally struggled.
Well, I would even go, remember the year Detroit had the four All-Stars and
right. They
were just being anointed as the super team? That was the worst thing that could have happened to them.
Right.
They peaked in February.
But you know what's funny is because I had this conversation with some people in their organization, and I always held that when those four were named All-Stars, that was the end. Because
that was it.
They weren't All-Stars. They're not All-Star. They began to think they could out-talent teams rather than out-work them. But yeah. I was told it started with the championship. That once they were champions, a little like the Celtics, they thought of themselves as champions. And we're champions and we're better than everybody else. Rather than, and this is where the comparison is very, very similar, rather than we were pretty good and we outworked everybody else.
Yeah, and you know what? That season, everybody kind of pointed to, oh yeah, Larry Brown, his relationship, and that's why this team didn't repeat. But really, the Artest melee enabled them to have that opportunity to get in the finals in the first place, and they ended up losing to a Spurs team that was really one of the weakest champions we've had. You know, that was a Spurs team that had Manu, not quite Manu yet. Parker was okay, not great. The big shot Rob made some big shots. Other than that, it wasn't a deep team. Duncan played terrible in the finals.
Yeah, it was
a weird season.
It was, and it was probably as thin a supporting cast as the Spurs have ever had too. I mean, they were pulling guys out of the hat too.
In an email, this 09, the 09 playoffs remind me of the 05 playoffs in that. In 05, Indiana, I felt like, was the best team, but they got knocked out. And then the Phoenix, that was the year Joe Johnson broke his face. They might have been the best team in the West. So you ended up with this finals where you had Pistons Spurs. It was ugly. There was really only one memorable game out of the seven. I kind of feel like this season, this postseason is going to be like that, where it's going to come down to who doesn't have that injury? Who gets that one lucky break? You know, it's and not the most talented team winning the title.
No, it's a little bit like last year, and maybe amplified even more because every team's flawed in that who you see and when you see them and how quickly you can get past them could have a huge impact on who ultimately gets there because. Some of the matchups, there's some teams that are really good, and there's just one matchup that they struggle mightily with. And that could decide whether they get there. And you mentioned Phoenix. Phoenix, the more I think about it, you talked about Joe Johnson breaking his face. I think of Steve Nash and the gash on his nose, the suspensions. Yep. I mean, if there's ever been a team that was just one positive thing happening versus one negative thing, and time and time and time again, it's the negative thing that happens that cuts their knees out from under them. It's been the Phoenix Suns. I mean, they really – I don't know that they'll ever get credit for having been as close to winning a ring one of these, like, last 5 years and never did and will ultimately just sort of extended the saga of disappointment in the desert.
I would throw in Duncan, the Finley Duncan threes in game one last year, because I still feel like they win that series if they win that game.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But, yeah.
And the weird thing is that it's always been a downer for them. In San Antonio, you can go back to the Fisher 0.4 second shot.
Right.
You know, teams that have won championships have also had those gut wrenching disappointments, but they've at least had some of the rewards. The Phoenix Suns have just been shut out from the ultimate reward.
Another good example in 2005, Miami is about to beat Detroit, and Dwayne Wade hurts his shoulder.
Right.
And they're going to win that series if that doesn't happen.
Right.
Yeah,
it
comes down to luck more often than you think with this stuff. I really do feel like the Celtics were the best team last year. I think it took them two rounds to get going, but I think, you know, by about midway through that Detroit series, they hit their stride. This year, especially because none of these teams really improved themselves at all. In fact, teams got worse. I just, every team has a flaw. Like, I even look at that Lakers team. What do they do if Bynum doesn't come back? I mean, seriously.
You know what? I'm not worried about them getting through the West. Without Bynum, they can still get through the West. Everybody keeps saying, San Antonio, look, they beat San Antonio in five games last year without Bynum.
Yeah, but Manu was on one leg, though. I mean,
yeah, but he's
going to
be on one leg again today.
I know.
This year.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
I don't know that that's changed.
That's true.
And as interesting as adding Gooden is, I mean, I'm sure he will help them. I don't what they need is somebody defensively. He gives them a little more post scoring, but he's not a great defender. The funniest part for me is that, you know, we talk about Big Shot Rob, and he was a great clutch player. He was a great versatile player, but you know what? He had trouble remembering rotations and plays and. And Drew Gooden is really, you know, if they were looking for a Robert Horry, they came pretty close with Drew as far as his ability to stick with the game plan. So I'll be interested to see how that plays out.
Well, if I were them, I didn't love the Drew Gooden move. I think he's just, as I said, I think he's a goofball. I don't know. Obviously he's more talented than Fabrizio Oberto, but I still think the guy they need, and maybe this can be Roger Mason, I kind of doubt it, is at least somebody to give Kobe trouble. Somebody who's like 6'7", 6'8", who can stick a hand in his face when he shoots jump shots. They don't have somebody like that in their roster. And they're going to have to go through Kobe probably to get to the finals. They just didn't address it. So I don't know. And now I'm feeling like even if Bynum doesn't come back, I think the Lakers make it. The one team that I kind of like. Yeah. As a dark horse, and their odds have dropped in the last week from 50-1 to 15-1, the Utah Jazz.
Yeah, you know, the one I got a note in the magazine this week. The one element that makes me question that is, well, two. One, defensively, they're still not right. They're just they're an odd team. Their small forward is their best shot blocker. Neither Okur nor Boozer are great defensively. And Darren Williams told me the other day that while he's back and he certainly is putting up the double doubles on a regular basis, and is back to his Stone Temple Pilots level of ability. I still can't believe you said that.
It's an insult. The Stone Temple Pilots had some good songs.
Anyway, he told me that he doesn't think he's going to be able to dunk off of 1 foot for the rest of this year until he can really rehab that ankle. And it doesn't sound like much, but when you get to the postseason and you're still having to measure what you can do off of 1 foot, that doesn't speak well. And he really, as he goes, the Jazz go. So that more than anything makes me question whether they're definitely a playoff team. I could easily see them getting through a round, but I can't see them posing a challenge.
Have you counted all the guys who are on the Redeem team? How many of them have gotten hurt? And not just that, but guys on other international teams as well? Surprisingly high number.
No, look at it historically.
Yeah.
Every year, even guys, like even the Ironmen, you can go back to the Stocktons and the Malones who continued to play, but clearly were playing through nagging injuries.
Yep.
And it always drives me crazy when people, and fans in particular, who don't recognize the sacrifice that is being made. Well, you're getting paid millions of dollars and it's patriotic and da 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 da, and it's like, well, first of all, you're not getting paid anything for playing for Team USA.
Well, actually you are, but it's under the table.
Yeah, there you go. And that's a whole other story, right?
Yeah.
And you're training during the off season, but the difference is You're not playing 9 games in 10 days. You're not playing, and anybody who's played in an organized game versus pickup can understand this to a tiny degree, which is when you're playing and you have to show up, you don't get to decide when you're going to shut it down. You don't get to decide, hey, you know what? Hammy's bothering me a little bit today. You know what? I'm not going to hit it today.
Well, and then throw in all the competitiveness that you have. Like, if you're Darren Williams and you're going against Chris Paul, this guy who's now your arch nemesis in the league, and you're going against him every day in practice, you're not going to coast.
Right.
You're going to try to kill this guy.
Absolutely. And you're playing, you know, throw in the travel, throw in the mental pressure of you're supposed to win gold if you're on Team USA. It is a grind. And
well, you and I were the only two people that in 2004, I think even mentioned in print that the fact that Duncan represented his country even after a long playoff season.
Right.
And Garnett, who made it to the Western Finals for the first time ever, bowed out because he was too tired. And then he comes the next season fresh. Duncan's exhausted, slugs through this season. He's injured. He's got 4 different injuries and then ends up playing like another 25 playoff games.
Right.
Like, to me, that's like, if you want to talk like top 5 reasons Tim Duncan is one of the 10 greatest players ever, look at what he did in 04 and 05.
Yep. No question about it. And what kills me is that people don't take that into consideration. If a guy struggles or if a guy doesn't look fresh, it's like, well, wait a minute. You're going to kill him if he doesn't play for Team USA. You're going to kill him if he doesn't play internationally. And yet you're not going to give him the benefit of the doubt when you get to the playoffs, or you get to the postseason, or you get anywhere during the season and the guy looks tired. It's like, what's wrong with him? You can't have it both ways and be fair.
Well, and you know, Lord knows I've taken a few shots at Kobe over the years, but you got to respect the way he manned up. Like, he plays hurt. Plays like 105 game season last year. Doesn't miss a game. He's playing 40, 41, 42, 45 minutes a game. Then immediately goes to the Olympic, goes through that whole experience, then comes back and still kills it every night. The guy never takes a night off. I think if you're going to praise Kobe, if you're in the Kobe camp, that is his number one greatest quality, I think. The fact, just how freaking competitive he is.
Did somebody cut in on this line? Is the producer on? Where did Bill go?
I saw him
somebody
play.
Somebody else jumped on the line.
Oh, stop. I saw him play Durant's team 3 weeks ago. Classic game that he just could have mailed in. You know, we're going to beat this team. I'm just going to shoot jump shots. Guy freaking killed it. Just went in.
You know what?
He played 140%.
I got to tell you, this is where I kind of appreciate, no, not kind of, I appreciate how he's approached the whole Shaq trying to kiss and make up thing, where he's been civil, but he makes it clear that, hey, you know what, Shaq, don't even try to play that. Don't even try to ask me to go along with this because look, I've been busting my butt all these years to be the best player I can be, and whatever you want to say about his personality or anything else, but he's not buying into the let bygones be bygones and let's revise history and all that stuff. He's looking at Shaq and going, you were a clown then and you're a clown now. And you know what? Hey, I'm trying to rehab my image a little bit, so I'll let you say whatever you want to say, but don't ask me to go along with this because I'm not. I respect that.
And that's been the most overrated story this year, is Shaq's resurgence, quote unquote. Because from the games I've seen, I don't know if it helps his team when he scores 35 points.
Yep. No,
what happened to the Shaq who showed up last year and said, I just want to rebound and block shots?
Yeah.
Now it seems like he's determined to prove that he can still be the man.
This is the thing that people, in my mind, always overlook, which is they look at a guy's stats and they say, oh, he's playing better. Well, hold on a second. Is his team winning? And what is he contributing to his team winning? And this is where all the talk, and look, has Devin Harris demonstrated that he's a better point guard than he was in Dallas? Has he done more than I thought he was capable of? Without question. Without question. But if you watch how they play and what he does, he's basically the same guy he was in Dallas. He's just got a little more freedom, and he's playing more minutes.
And people run, look at it they and go, plays for him.
And exactly. And he's free to take – he's one, he's free to take a lot of shots and not put the same effort in defensively. So
well, I would say
at the end
that...
of the day, here's the thing for me with Devin Harris. If they end up making the playoffs, I will give you the biggest mea culpa. I would say, you know what? I was wrong about Devin Harris. But if they don't, then I don't want to hear about what a great point guard he is. Because at the end of the day, you have, especially as a point guard, you have got to help your team win. And I'll even go the other way. Jason Kidd doesn't get Dallas to the playoffs. If they don't get one of those spots, then I'll say, you know what? Jason Kidd is no longer what we always presumed him to be.
I'm going to say that right now. How many triple doubles does he have to give up to other teams' point guards? Russell Westbrook now in the bracket. Russell Westbrook gets to tell his family that he had a triple double in his rookie season because he played against Jason Kidd. How many point guards can kill him?
Let's get to the end of the year.
Hold on, we're running out of time, so quickly give me your finals.
Cavs, Lakers, one sleeper. One sleeper. I don't think there's a sleeper.
Utah's a sleeper.
I'd say New Orleans is a sleeper before Utah's a sleeper.
Do you like
they've got to be healthy.
Do you like the Sean Elliott voided trade kind of parallels to what was that trade? Remember
actually,
that? Houston 94?
Yeah. He went to Detroit. And he was hating life, the fact that he was going to Detroit from Houston, I believe.
Yeah, I'm going to look
for
this up.
No. I take that back.
It was Big Shot Rob. The trade got voided.
Yeah, it was for Big Shot Rob.
And then the Rockets ended up winning.
Flipped it back. Yep.
Right?
Yep, exactly right. And you know what? And I would say that what I'm interested in is seeing is whether this has sort of the same galvanizing effect for the Hornets, where they go, hey, you know what? We just realized this is the last time together. A little bit like Seattle when they had all those guys that were free agents to be,
mm-hmm.
and they all said, you know what? We're not coming this way again. We know that we're going to be done after this year. Let's just go out and let it rip. And I just wonder whether that can have a it at least appears to be having more of a positive effect than a negative effect so far.
I will say this. I would not want to win a do-or-die game in Utah with the way that crowd is and the way that they can take refs out of the game. No crowd takes out the refs like that Utah crowd.
Well, as you know, my history of speaking about things in Utah, Salt Lake City, and that
I know.
Band,
you,
I'm taking a complete pass on that, other than to say this. They continue to be the most obnoxious fans in the NBA. They say more untoward things than any Philly crowd has ever said. And I'll leave it at that.
I would say that seems to be the consensus. And, you know, with the way the officiating, oh, my God. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
This could be the season when officiating actually changes who wins the title. And you could argue that happened in 2006. But I'm talking about, like, one call that is so badly screwed up that we will remember it Don Denkinger style for the rest of our lives. Could be this
maybe
year.
But it's the greater issue is just however you're going to call the game, call it consistently.
And
the way they change how the game is being called, the level of physicality that you're allowed, and to me that tears at the integrity of the game more than anything else.
And I say it with the Celtics every game I watch because they're probably the most physical team in the league. And
right.
You have to decide in the first quarter, am I going to call this stuff or am I not? And the Celtics have no idea from game to game. I'm not defending the way they play because, you know, obviously they're a little too physical. But
right.
they don't know. They might have games where they could just do whatever. Or they'll have other games where everything they do is a tic-tac foul. There's no rhyme or reason to it.
Yeah, you know where I think it's gone a little sideways is that one of the emphasis this year has been to try not to call the automatic touch foul inside. And I got to tell you, I've seen more plays, I've seen more shots at the rim challenged where you think, oh my gosh, there had to be contact there, and yeah. they don't whistle it. And again, you know what? That is just coming down from the league saying, this is the way we want it officiated. And some guys are better at that than others. And that's where you get in, you get the wild inconsistencies.
So you're saying we've seen a decrease in the bailout calls?
Without question.
I would agree with that, except I happened to watch the Cleveland-Atlanta game on Saturday night where LeBron basically ended up winning the game on probably the biggest bailout call of the year. Just lurched into four people and got a call.
Here's the two things that they've been told that conflict, which is, okay, we want you to really see contact before you blow that whistle. And then one of the other messages is we want the game called the same way in the last 3 seconds as it is in the first 3 seconds or in the middle 3 seconds or wherever. And so believe me, look, when you are a referee and you're having to make these split second decisions and you're getting these different points of emphasis.
Yep.
They start to blend, and it's like, okay, well, I got this point of emphasis, and I got this point of emphasis, and okay, which one is supposed to be the greater point of emphasis when they conflict?
Well, you just hit the problem, is the fact that the leadership and direction of these guys is abysmal and continues to be abysmal. And they claim that they made a big fuss about hiring General Robert Johnson, but the word I'm getting is that guy is not running the show like they make believe he is. And that, what's that guy's name? Joe Lipvin?
Yes.
That his name? He's still basically running the show. And this is the guy who, under his direction, a lot of the problems happened. And Stu Jackson. And Ronnie Nunn.
I cannot put that on Lipvin.
And Ronnie Nunn and Stu Jackson.
Yeah, ultimately, at the end of the day, you put it on David Stern, because David Stern is more directly involved with how things are adjudicated than anybody else. And there are a lot of decisions where if you talk to anybody in the league office, the bottom line is it goes to David, and they can discuss it all they want, and they can look at all the clips they want, and they can at the end of the day, it ends up on David Stern's desk, and he makes that ultimate decision. And I don't know that that's necessarily the best thing.
It's a very fair point, and he promised after the Donahue thing to clear this up. And I watched the games, and I don't feel like it's been cleared up. And the fact that they still will not move to some sort of modified ref quota during the playoffs and just make sure that their best guys are officiating the biggest games is insane to me. It's insane. Yeah. The first and second round should not be a reward for your mediocre refs for a good season. You want your best guys doing these games. You just do.
Yeah, I don't know that it comes to that. The one element that they could address, and I know that they're fearful of it, is that when there is already a preconceived idea, whether it's by the teams or the public, that a certain guy with a certain team or a certain coach does not get along, or there's just any insinuation
Crawford Spurs.
Guy does not officiate them fairly,
yep,
not put him in the series.
Crawford Spurs, last game of the Spurs-Lakers. He should not have been, and I think he's one of the three or four best officials, but you can't put him in. You can't have him.
You put him in a no-win situation.
Yeah.
You don't do the referee any favors.
No.
By doing that, and they're so and for me, it's all about appearances. The league so wants you to convince you that we believe in the veracity of our officials. We believe that they don't carry any grudges or whatever. And I'm not saying they do. I'm just saying, look, just avoid the issue. You got enough guys that you don't have to try to make a point and say, we're going to have this guy officiate this game to show you what we think. You're beating us over the head with something. Just avoid the issue. We're not going to presume. I mean, as people are, there's always going to be the conspiracy theorists. People are always going to say, we can go back to me not working a playoff game in Utah when I was originally scheduled to do it. The blogosphere immediately said that was because of my comments on the radio. Had nothing to do with it. I switched assignments because somebody couldn't make one of the other games and needed to be closer to Salt Lake City. But that wasn't publicly put out there. So you're always going to have people who are going to see two things happen and try to connect the dots.
Well put. The biggest thing that I worry about is that it's this constant new crop of young guys. Mm. You always see him be like, oh, who's that guy? I haven't seen him before.
Right.
I can't remember the last time I've seen a young ref or even a ref like around my age that I thought, wow, that guy has potential. That guy's going to be really good.
Zach Zarba.
Like, who?
Zach Zarba.
I don't know if I've seen him yet. I like Scott Foster.
Sure,
I like
Scott
Foster.
Scott Foster, very good. But
how old is he, though? Is he our age?
For a young guy who came, yeah, for a guy who came in and immediately, Zach Zarba, I think, is actually younger than us. He's probably, maybe he is about right there. I want to say he's 30s, mid-30s.
He's born in 1975, uniform number 58. I'm going to look for him. I think it's a good thing if I don't know who that is, because I think when you don't notice the refs, that means they're doing their job.
He's in my mind, he's, I don't know if he's one of the best, but he came in and he's been solid right from the start. And this is where I got to tell you, I mean, this is where it's difficult when you're the low man on the totem pole. Everybody out there knows you're the low man on the totem pole, and they work you nonstop. And the things that a Bennett Salvatore gets away with, his call may be no better than David Goebbels, but Goebbels is going to be worked and just doesn't have the experience. You know, he knows he's a rookie. I mean, it's like a rookie player,
yeah.
Except you're to be the cop on the beat.
I'm fascinated by the whole ref thing. I wish somebody kept a ref blog. All the blogs we have in the world, there should be a ref blog. All right, we'll let you go. Rick Bucher, always a pleasure. We'll see you on the sideline on Friday night, Cleveland-Boston, right?
No, I'm not working that game.
I thought you were.
No. I'm going.
Right.
But I'm going because of our Saturday commitment. I'm going to
go
Friday and Sunday.
Yes.
I'm going to see them against Orlando, too.
Buke and I will be at the Sloan Sports Conference at MIT, which I have jokingly titled Dorkapalooza 2009.
Sold out.
Sold out.
Obviously, they've appealed to the right market.
Yes. All right. I'll see you this weekend. Thanks again.
You got it.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
So I get the sound off.
Whoa. Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.